Hello, hello, hello.
Dan? Dan? Dan! You're here! I thought you were gone forever.
No. I told you before, and I may have mentioned in my column, I moved away from Manitoba to Ontario because my wife got a fantastic job opportunity, and it was her turn to move us. And but I'm still working for the Free Press, and it feels like I never left. Through the miracle of technology, we are happy to welcome our listeners to Negan and the Lone Ranger podcast, now nationwide. Why?
Come on, you're not here. It's just Negan on the empty chair now.
Oh man, don't be so dramatic. Like most of the time before, you were usually on the road. So I was alone in the studio and we were either splicing you in or bringing you in by Zoom. So this is how we usually do it.
Okay, are true, but I really liked having you here because you always brought Adam and I donuts and baked goods and even coffee when we taped. You weren't just my podcast partner, but my caterer, my parent, the producer of this show all at the same time. You did it all. In fact, you were kind of like Tonto, and I'm the Lone Ranger taking all the glory while you do all the work.
Oh my God, you're right. Now I know why I left. What the hell am I doing here?
Oh no. Adam,
Yes, Negan?
do you bake? Hi ho, empty chair away.
The Winnipeg Free Press proudly presents, in partnership with CJNU 93.7 FM, Negan and the Lone Ranger. Here are your hosts, Negan Sinclair and Dan the Lone Ranger Lett.
Hey there, Tonto and the Lone Ranger. Is that what
I
we're renaming it
feel
now?
very, very lonely that you're so far away. I'm not gonna lie.
Well, now you know how I felt while you were gallivanting across the continent, and cruise ships and conferences and.
I don't like it, and I'd like you to come home now.
Okay. Hang on. I'll be there in 36 hours.
Okay, well, it's fine.
Yeah.
I suppose you can go off and be a good husband, partner, and I'm glad you're still writing for the Free Press. But
Me
I
too.
think you are very ambitious to do the kind of hard-hitting reporting and detailed stuff that you are. You're missing out on Winnipeg. Let me tell you, Winnipeg's not the same without you.
Well, I appreciate that. And honestly, I really miss Winnipeg. But, I think, I don't know if this is going to happen, but we'd actually talked about how, because you come to Ontario for business quite often. And I live here in lovely Prince Edward County, Ontario,
I wasn't going to
Southeast.
disclose where you are, but okay.
Okay. Well, like if somebody wants to come and get me here, come on.
Okay, fine. You know what I call your place of where you're living now? The heart of where Sir John A. Macdonald defined
Yes.
himself. And so I will personally come to that area, but to probably remove a statue or two.
Every other street in this entire county is named after Sir John A. Macdonald. Like it's hard to kind of get away from it if you need to get away from it. But in 2 weeks' time, your favorite band is playing in Ontario, and we talked about maybe doing a live remote.
I'm sure our listeners would very much want to hear the Watchmen in the background as we discuss politics and life on the ground. But I can't think of any better way for to do an episode. We are in the midst of lots of different things happening in Manitoba. While you've been gone, we've been a province that have been full of controversy, been full of conflict. There's ministers being told they're supposed to resign.
Roasted, the place has fallen apart since I left, for sure.
It
And
is not doing well.
I'm not saying that I had something to do with it, that my departure had something to do with it. But today we're actually going to get to talk about all of the stuff, good, bad, and ugly, with Premier Wab Kanu, who is making his 14th appearance on the
I was
podcast.
going to say, remember how, like, on Saturday Night Live, where you get a jacket? He's now
No, we've
graduated
talked.
jacket status. He's no longer t-shirt anymore.
I'm going to make a limited edition t-shirt, and by limited edition, I mean six of them. For you, me, the premier, my son, my daughter needs one, and my daughter's boyfriend needs one. Well, actually, maybe not her boyfriend, but certainly one of her other friends who really loves the podcast. So, yeah, that's the budget. We can make six. Anyways, here is our feature interview with Premier Wahb Kanuk. Our most frequent guest, who's on his 22nd appearance on the podcast. Premier, thank you very much for taking the time to do this.
Thanks for having me back. You think you're still around 20, 21, but to hear that you're on the 22nd appearance is something else. It's an
Yeah, as soon
honor. We were saying earlier that on like Saturday Night Live, you get like a jacket now instead of a t-shirt. So it's in the
as
mail.
yeah, blazer.
Am I the Steve Martin of your podcast or
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
the jerk?
No, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Things after this, things are going to start happening for you soon.
Nice.
We wanted to time this because you're fast approaching, just in a couple of weeks, the second anniversary of your time in government. And how many mornings have you woken up and wondered, what the hell have I done?
There's been a lot of times where I'm like, is this for real? Like, I still can't believe it. I actually was having a sweat a couple weekends ago in Onigaming, the community that I'm from. And like the other guys my age there who've known me since birth, effectively, they just like looked at me and they're like, do you ever wonder, like, is this real? Are you really the premier of Manitoba? So it's definitely kind of the pinch me effect. But yeah, it's been the best job in the world. There's obviously challenges. There's times where it's a grind, but it feels pretty amazing to get to wake up every day and go to the legislature or go visit people and serve as their premier.
Nobody trains for the job. Like you can't train for the job of premier by being premier. That's not to say that, there aren't some people who've been premier who came back and were premier again, but it rarely happens. So what would you say is the biggest and most surprising things you've learned about the job of being premier that you didn't know before?
Well, on the way into office, Gary Dewar, before the campaign started, he said, get out to Lake of the Woods or take some time now because you're going to be very busy when you win the election, is basically what he said. And he was right. The pace and the demands on your focus, energy, not just like, physical energy, but also like the mental and emotional capacity to work with others is unlike anything else. So you can intellectually know what the job is going to entail and understand the schedule and all that. But when you actually get to experience it first person, it's something else. And I think that's part of going from year one to year two is learning how to govern and then hopefully learning how to govern at a higher standard. And just getting those things right about what being a leader of a provincial government is all about. And yeah, having some good advice like Dewar or others is definitely a huge help.
I have two questions about it, the past time since you've started. The first is, who could have predicted this unprecedented moment just south of us, in that maybe perhaps people could have seen it coming, but that much of your time as premier has been not working as much on local issues, although you've certainly dealt with things. I'll ask that in the second question, but you've dealt with this American president. Did you ever think you'd be facing off against United States president?
I don't think to the extent that it's happened. I don't think anyone expected that. We announced Dewar as our trade advisor in the campaign in 2023. We traveled down with him and a bunch of business leaders and labor leaders in 2024. And during that time, I think we thought, hey, there's a good chance Donald Trump gets back in again, so we need to lay the groundwork for how we're going to respond to a second Trump administration. But we're also hedging our bets, thinking like whether it's Biden or Kamala, that there's going to be some protectionism we have to contend with on, no matter who is the next president. But even, as a group of people who are preparing for a possible Trump 2.0, I don't think I don't think anyone expected him to be the way that he is now. Like, there's going to be a UFC event at the White House. It seems more like a movie some days than like a real government. The acetaminophen stuff from yesterday, well, as we're recording this yesterday, there's just so many things that have surprised us. But to the point of your question, I think it's been a pretty exciting opportunity to help shape the national conversation. Obviously, the prime minister and the federal government lead, and they have the loudest megaphone. But Doug Ford, Premiers Smith and Moe, myself, Andrew Furey, many others, David Eby, have all been out there at different times, helping to shape the conversation. And I'd hope that we brought that kind of prairie pragmatism and the perspective that Western Canada needs to be included. It can't just be Ontario and Quebec. It has to be the West too. And of course, we've maybe brought some Indigenous content to that discussion as well too. The idea of the Indigenous nationhood on both sides of the border, and how does that play into the economic or other impacts of this relationship. So yeah, I don't think even the people who expected Trump to get reelected expected it to turn out the way that it is. But this is why you try to do your best job to prepare for your time in government, so that you can respond to the unforeseen. And through the first couple of years in office, Trump is definitely the most noticeable, but there's been a ton of unexpected things that we've had to respond to.
And probably led to some of the most entertaining parts of your time as premier. Your impressions of Donald Trump and the way that you've subtly imitated him at certain moments, including signing big documents, holding press conferences. Even I heard your staff, up to the much chagrin of your staff, doing a little bit of an impression of his voice. It's hard not to be sort of caught up in the kind of circus of it all. At the same time, there's been a little bit of concern that maybe the pressure is getting to you. There has been a few moments, I think, maybe understandably so, for the pressures that you spoke about, but certainly have been recorded where in which you've been a little bit prickly with the media too. So, are you feeling some of the kind of the as the shine of the beginning of the government comes off, things are really the rubber's hitting the road?
Well, the rubber hits the road immediately on your way into office, I would say, first of all. And yeah, the Trump thing kind of gets out there. The prime minister, actually, you saw his White House audition there, the meeting where he was there with Trump. And then they go, after doing the media, they go in the back and talk. He brought me a marker from the White House. It has Donald Trump's signature on it. And he said, I think you're. I forget the exact note he wrote, but he's like, you sign many tremendous, amazing orders in Manitoba with this
Big,
marker.
big, beautiful
Big,
orders.
beautiful
Yeah,
orders.
that's
Yeah,
right.
that's just what he was saying. So that gets out there, and you just roll with it. And yeah, I'm not going to be perfect 100% of the time. So when it comes to the media, you folks have an important role to play. I think about the role of the media quite a bit. And I do think that there's, a special responsibility that journalists have too in the current era, because let's be real, like some reporting ends up being clickbait. But some reporting is seriously a public good that moves the conversation in a constructive way. So I think about all that, and yeah, I value the role of journalists in serving the public good, and I hope that journalists think about that too in terms of reporting on stories that are relevant to the bigger picture.
So, this is a safe place. We've always made the podcast is a safe place. So, you can tell us if there's a particular reporter in town who really gets under your skin. Like, it's, you know, this is a safe place. You can do that. And I could suggest some names for you.
Why don't we just go through them all one by one? And I'll give you like a thumbs up, thumbs down, thumb to the side kind of thing.
Yeah. Would Negan and I have to be on that list? Because if so, we're going to move on to the next question. So, I mean, I think, you know, you obviously, and I'm sure Gary Dewar helped prepare, that you're living your life in such a fishbowl right now. And I heard a story recently about when you were at a few months ago, when you were at a gathering of premiers, that Blue Rodeo was playing. And Jim Cuddy took time out to say that when he told his family that he was coming to play a concert in front of the premiers, the only thing his son wanted was for him to do a selfie with you. So, you can tell me if I've got it wrong, but I will tell you that I may have gotten it from Gary Dewar, who was at the meeting. So I just reveal my source.
Now I know never to be your source. No, just kidding.
No, I know. But that's kind of a whole weird level of profile and popularity. And like, is that actually a benefit to the job you're trying to do? Is it a burden, that kind of notoriety?
Well, your story is true. That did happen at the Council of the Federation. Blue Rodeo was playing kind of like the closing social event as part of the premier's meeting in July. And it was awesome to meet,
right.
You know, I'll date myself here, but like, you know, the people you used to see on Much Music when, Lost Together was the number one song in the country. That was pretty awesome to have a chance to talk to them. And that's very, very cool. I would say it's helpful insofar as if that can open doors for Manitoba in other areas, or if that can help move things along, I think that's great. I think a lot of the focus on the Port of Churchill is really exciting right now. So if we can use, the federal government's interest in that, and if any, goodwill that our government has built up allows us to advance that more quickly, I could see that being a really positive thing. I could also see it, being positive inside the borders of our own province. Like, we just went through this Spruce Woods by-election, which was supposed to be, this yellow dog, safe conservative seat. And it was effectively a toss-up on election day. And I think part of that is, just going to small town Manitoba, if you will, visiting communities like Glenborough and Wawanisa and Rivers, and, visiting some of the Hutterite colonies in the area. And I don't know if people open the door to me to the same extent, or come talk to me to the same extent, if we hadn't, received a lot of goodwill from social media and the media. And then that might get your foot in the door. And then maybe people realize, well, NDP is not necessarily the party I'm used to voting for in this part of Manitoba, but I agree with feeding kids in school. I agree with building up Churchill to be a big export terminal. I agree with more staff working in healthcare. Maybe I'll give them a hearing. And so, again, I'm looking at it from a partisan perspective, but hopefully what we can do when we do have, Manitoba more in the public eye is just find a way to bring people together and to recognize that there's a lot more unity in our province than people might sometimes think at the start.
So as much as you're living a lot of your life in public, you have carved out some moments to do important things sort of away from the camera. So I was recently told that you've been taking some time out to visit offenders at the Manitoba Youth Center, and that's been done totally on the down low. I mean, we do know that you have frequently spoken directly to the Nietzsches, as you call them, in some of your speeches, and trying to encourage Indigenous youth to find a more positive path. The Manitoba Youth Center thing, I know you don't want to get deep into the conversations there, but what was your motivation there, and how does that connect to your bigger message?
Yeah, well, I think, just to frame up the conversation, so like the vast majority of Indigenous youth are on a positive path, and are doing amazing things in school, just being social people, sports, athletes. You know, that's the vast, vast majority. It's people like my kids, like Negan's kids, like all of our cohort and age, like all of our kids are doing amazing things right there along the rest of society. But the reality is when you visit the youth center, it is like overwhelmingly Indigenous youth who are in there. You also have, you know, Black youth in there, other people from other cultural communities, non-Indigenous people as well. But those are like the vast, vast majority is, you know, BIPOC, as I guess we would say in some circles. And I'll be heading there, I think, actually this Friday. So I don't know when the episode drops, but I'll be there on the Friday before Orange Shirt Day to help with the Orange Shirt Day activities that they have. And from what I understand is I'll just be listening to some of the presentations and speeches that the youth there have been putting together. And I just feel like we have this window. I think, you know, whether you look at it from a brain science perspective, as, you know, people's brains develop until they're 25 years old, or if you just look at it from like a parent's perspective and like how you've been able to mold your kids over the years to, you know, bring out the more positive characteristics and maybe talk to them and nurture, you know, some of the more challenging moments. I just think we have this window of opportunity when people come to us at the youth center. And I'm speaking us now as the provincial government or us collectively as the province of Manitoba. We have this opportunity for maybe a few months, maybe even a few years. Like, let's be realistic. Some of these kids have done some pretty bad things to try and get them to change their lives around. And I think that for those kids in the youth center, a lot of them, you know, are coming from some really rough walks of life. Some of them, there's a ton of them from the reserves across the province. A lot of them are from inner city or other inner city environments outside of Winnipeg too. And they haven't necessarily had that opportunity. And I just looked at, you know, I visited there over the years off and on, but going back as the premier, I was just like, you know, you got these kids who are causing harm to themselves and to others in the community. I'm talking to the correctional officers who work with them. And a few of these correctional officers were like, I was in here as a youth. And having a correctional officer take the time with me helped me to get onto a positive path. And so I started to think like, okay, yeah, we do have the ability to make a change here. And then, like, you know, one of these correctional officers, popular guy with the youth, you know, you can tell he works out. And so he comes at it from a perspective of like, you know, I'm looking at some of these kids and they don't have fine motor skill development. And, you know, you just think about that and it just reveals so much about the condition of growing up that some of these kids are coming from is like they didn't have somebody there with them saying, let's play catch, let's go to hockey, you know, let's do these, you know, homework activities, coloring or writing, you know, together. And absolutely don't make excuses for people who've been, you know, violent or antisocial or stuff like that. But at the same time, there has to be some connection of like somebody is doing harm in the community because they did not have a guiding hand to put them on the path of school, to put them on the path of sports, put them on the path of community. And that this kid's brain is still growing. We still have the chance to reach them. We could still turn them into a more positive direction. So that's basically where it started. The other big thing that one of the correctional officers shared with me was just like more so on an emotional level, coming from a challenging environment, having somebody say, you know, you can change your environment. That made a difference for him. So I just wanted to give a venue for these kids who, again, not to excuse any actions, not to let anyone off the hook, but just to say that isn't our society going to be better off if for that 2 months they're going to school instead of just, you know, fighting each other in the youth center? Or, you know, if they're there for a year, if they got their GED instead of, you know, they got a gang affiliation while they're in the youth center. So I wouldn't necessarily talk about the visits too much in and of themselves, but going to visit the youth in the youth center, it helped me to understand a lot of what they're up against and consequently what our society is up against when we try to address youth crime. And I really do think like education is the solution, because the school system in the general public is the way that we can intervene in the lives of youth across our society. And in the youth center itself, if we add teachers, mental health professionals, occupational therapists who would help somebody with a diagnosis adapt their education so that it suits their needs, whether that's an ADHD or maybe it's a mobility or maybe it's another kind of need that gets identified, you know, to me, that could be a positive path forward. And yeah, it's for young Nietzsche's, but it's for everybody out there, because sadly, we have an overrepresentation of Indigenous people in some tough living conditions, but it extends to people from all backgrounds. Poverty and intergenerational trauma might be disproportionate in one area, but it doesn't really know any boundaries. I know people from all walks of life can go through some hard times.
Yeah, and fact is everybody works together, lives together, is impacted by the systems, right? So, during the election campaign, two big issues. I think back to your previous appearance and or maybe the previous appearance. I have to try to remember which appearance. But 18. That's right. It's about 103rd. So the two big issues during the election campaign, one you wanted to drive, and then the other one was sort of foisted upon you foisted upon Manitoba. Of course, healthcare is the first one, so I'm going to return to that in just a minute. But the searching of the landfill, probably your government's arguably one of the biggest successes, came in under budget, resulted in findings fairly quickly, where it was expected to take year up to, you know, even 18 months to 2 years to search the site, came in quite quickly. How monumental was that as for you as a government to be able to put not that issue to bed, but because we're still searching, we're still dealing with, of course, the terrible issue, tragedy involving the loss of our relatives and Indigenous women and girls, Two-Spirit peoples as well. But how important is that of an issue that for your government achieved?
Well, Ashley Shingus, we have to acknowledge her and her family, a Buffalo woman. And, we're searching a landfill for her, Tanya Nipinak. You know, we're planning. That will be a much different search, given the length of time that's gone by. But, you know, what I would say to folks curious about the behind the scenes or what happened is I would talk to some of the staff who worked on this, and I would say, like, keep this sacred, keep this reverent, keep a reverent attitude about this work, because this is first and foremost, it's about, you know, two women who are taken away from their families far too soon. But also the way that the issue was brought to us, we never asked for it. It was given to us by the other side in their choosing to campaign on this. And I didn't want to take advantage of the issue in a similar sort of way. So, you know, I always just try to keep that in mind when we think about where this fits in. I think this was part of a moment where the courts brought the families in to the sentencing process, to the courtroom itself during the trial, and sent a message of you matter, your family member matters. And I hope we did that in government too, by doing the successful search and bringing Morgan Mercedes home, sending a message, your loved ones have dignity and compassion. And most importantly, for the rest of the population, I hope people in Manitoba just feels like this was a good thing for our province in the end, that we send a message when somebody goes missing, we go looking, but also we just send a message of respect as people. Like, even if the landfill search had not brought them home, I think the fact that Manitobans rejected the message of division just sent a clear statement: Manitobans want respect to be exercised. And I think that's really important for us. And, you know, there's just so many beautiful things that happened along the way, like Cambria and Jordan, two of the young women from each of the families who emerged as public spokespeople, and just the eloquence and power that they have. The ceremonial moments that we've done together, whether it was smoking the pipe in the legislature or being on the side of the hill. And there were so many like personal moments too, watching the first truck drive down the side of the PGL landfill and just thinking like, holy cow, this is finally happening after all the protests and all the attention. And then also like feeling a pretty visceral sense of like, oh my God, are we going to do a belly flop here? Is this going to be, you know, something that just doesn't pan out and leaves everybody more divided and maybe more angry? But you know, you as with anything in life, you have to accept the anxiety and move forward with what you think is the right thing to do. And you know, God willing, we had these amazing civil servants and contractors and engineers working with us. You know, Amna Makan, who you've seen at some of the press conferences, just came up with this amazing search method that, after studying what had been done in other places, that allowed us to have this success. And so it was really just like this constellation of good people trying to do what they believe to be the right thing that led us to a good place. And that includes the voters who sent us into office, at the very least saying that they wanted to reject the vision, if not outright saying they wanted to search the landfill.
So, I mean, I think that I haven't seen any polling on this, but I think that that arguably could be the your government's greatest success so far. Although, certainly, I think the role that you played in the country, absent of a prime minister, Justin Trudeau resigns, and sort of the role that you're playing in terms of standing up to Trump might have been equally polling very high. To a recent issue that's become quite a thorn, I think, in the side, media is reporting that the big promise of healthcare that your election campaign promised has been uneven at best, is my best way to describe it. There's the doctors and nurses. Nurses haven't come back at the trail in which, although I remember distinctly on our podcast, you said there was going to be a culture change within nursing. People were going to want to come back to work. Doctors have definitely not come back, or we haven't been able to
You read the
hire
Free
the number
Press?
of doctors to.
You see,
The
Miguel, this is going to be one of those
no, it's
prickly
not. I'm just
moments.
curious.
So just strap in, man, okay?
I do read the Free Press,
Well,
but then
read that
also
above the
just lastly,
fold
and I'll
in the
totally
past week. What
respond.
did it say about doctors?
Okay, well, MRI weights are up, and at the highest level since 2019, according to reporting. Do you want to respond to that? Some criticism is that the healthcare file isn't been quite got the same vigor as some of the other files in your
Oh,
government.
there's a ton of vigor and smarts and good people working on health. And you know, from the start when we were campaigning on this issue, we said this is going to take years to fix because it took us years to get here. You know, consolidation of the hospitals under Pallister and continuing on to Stephenson started in 2017, right? And it went up until the election. And so for us, it's going to take a multi-year project of consistent effort in the opposite direction, in the direction of staffing, to reverse the damage. The areas that I would point to, though, for signs that we are focused on this and we are delivering is on the staff numbers themselves. We've added 3,000 staff. We've added more than 1,000 nurses. It's actually over 1,100 nurses working province-wide right now. The Free Press reported more than 160 physicians. And there was a lot of frustration with the bureaucracy in health, and we've dismissed a lot of people from those senior decision-making roles over the first 2 years in government. So what I would say as like the highest level response, and I'm happy to dive into the details, is we've put the first steps of a multi-year plan into place. The next steps are focused on the ER waits. Again, you break that down and we can show results like bed block is one thing that physicians point to quite a bit. We've got a pretty great bed block clearing program, I'll call it, under the leadership of Dan Roberts at the Grace Hospital that's starting to show some results. We'll have to do some stuff in the ERs proper beyond what's already been done there. We got the safety issue where we're adding police and we're working with the city and the Winnipeg Police Service on that, and then building the Vic ER. So we've got all these sort of next stage plans, but I mean, none of those things would be possible if we didn't start with the staff. And so the staffing piece, and we said this in the election, not only it's going to take years to fix, but we also said it has to start with staff. And so, yeah, I think part of the way you accomplish big things like fixing healthcare is you maintain commitment to a long-term goal over multiple years, even in the face of criticism or having to answer questions about how it's going.
The mental health addictions and homelessness file runs very close parallel to healthcare. I think on the, and I wrote my newsletter this week about how do we assess progress in the homelessness addictions and mental health file, because it's getting worse everywhere. There is a lot of effort being put in, a lot of money being put in, even in Houston, which was at one time the model. They're really suffering at this point. Now, a lot of that, of course, has to do with the fact that the Trump administration nuked like $500 million worth of funding for homelessness initiatives, but that's for another podcast. Here in Manitoba, you guys have been trying to do your version of the Houston model, finding stable housing, wraparound services. I'd like to, get your thoughts on how much progress and what you perhaps your government has learned about the pace of progress, like how quickly it really is going to take. I'd like to ask about supervised consumption.
Sure.
Because that turned out to be a bit of a speed bump in the, but an important element of it. What do you think, has your government, fully sort of come to an idea of how long it's going to take to get people off the street on a permanent basis?
Yeah, so in the election campaign, we said 8 years is how long the homelessness plan would take, which means we're in year two of eight right now. And we moved 80 people out of tents and into homes. We've added about 180 social housing units, which are online today that weren't there in the past. But the reality is, what is the test? The test is not those statistics. The test is, do you drive down Main Street past Higgins and Main, past the Thunderbird House, and you feel proud of Winnipeg or Canada or Manitoba, right? Or do you drive down Disraeli towards downtown? And so on and so forth. I could list off many, many other locations where people see this. And so the reality is we're not there yet. We got a lot more work to do on homelessness. And that is the real test. The real test to me is not necessarily a healthcare or a housing number, as important as those are. To me, it's really an emotional test for Manitobans. Do you feel proud of our city or of our province when you go around? Or is the very visible sign of meth or homelessness making you less proud? And I'm not making a value judgment. Maybe some people are blaming the victim, so to speak, the people suffering with addictions themselves. Maybe other people are blaming us as policy people. But the question is pride. Do you feel like we're there yet? And so there's a lot more work to do. So we're trying to add social housing units for people living in tents right now as quickly as we can. Very recently, we've dragged down a couple of trailers to the 190 Disraeli site, which we now own as a province as well. We own 190. And so we're kind of expanding into that next phase of moving people from tents and into homes. But as a society, this meth use is kicking our butt. And we've got to find a way to get a handle on this. And, I talk to physicians. I'm lucky to, have a physician very close that I can talk to all the time in the form of my wonderful wife, Lisa. But, if we're talking to her cohort or we're talking to people on the street, business owners, people working addictions, like there's not really a silver bullet when it comes to meth use. It is this long, tough problem to try and get somebody off of it and get somebody stable. The good news is that 80 number doesn't sound necessarily huge when you drive by Higgins and Main, but all those people have stayed housed, which is important. There hasn't been any backsliding from those 80 people we've moved out of tents. So that's important progress. And this is an area that I show personal attention to. And, what I've asked our team to do is to show some results before we get to snowfall. We know that people will move indoors as a result of the cold weather, but I want to move us even beyond that 80 number by the time winter gets here in terms of moving homelessness along.
So in supervised consumption, and I will say I may be next to you and Minister Smith, I might be the only other person in the province that thought it was a good idea, what you were planning. A site in South Point Douglas, north end of the eastern edge of the Exchange District, an area where that is, it's where a lot of homeless people congregate. It's where there's a ton of open drug use. So I mean, I saw the and the other thing is too, I'm unburdened by the mythology that some other provinces try to sell about supervised consumption making neighborhoods worse, which is I don't believe that's true. But I would have to say I'm profoundly disappointed that you guys backed off that plan. What in the end, what was the problem there? Like why was it incumbent upon your government to abandon that first plan? And I guess everybody's working on plan B right now, but like why back off of it if you believed enough in it the first time to propose it?
Well, we said we'd listen to the community, and we heard a lot of pushback from the community. And Bernadette Smith is the one who has to sit in the consultation sessions. Like I sat in a few sessions. I'll make that clear. But Bernadette is the one who was there in the front lines and really hearing an earful. And I think with anything in public health, you have to have the community buy-in. If the community doesn't support the direction, it's not going to work. So we're looking at another area further west. So if you think of that North Main area, and again, I agree, like Main Street Project, Siloam, Salvation Army, so many of the services that this group of Manitobans are going to access is in that area. But we're looking further west. So if you think of like Logan, Henry going west, that area, that's where we're looking at for it. And the main thing is we just want to turn what is right now, a conversation about addictions into a conversation about healthcare and tying people into health services. So if people come in to the door of this future supervised consumption site, we want them to be able to say, can I get a testing for an STBBI, HIV, what have you? Can I get a pregnancy test? Can I access a doctor or nurse practitioner appointment? And hopefully that is the ladder to treatment, or a ladder to housing, or a ladder out of living in a tent. And that's what we're focused on. And yeah, there's a lot of misinformation out there. The issue gets politicized, and it's not just the other provinces. Even within our own province, you'll have a PC leader sitting in the committee face to face saying, oh yes, language is very important, and then they turn around and put out press releases which are like, drug injection site. And then that's why we're pretty careful about the wording supervised consumption, because we do want to make clear this is about healthcare. This is not about inflaming the situation. This is about finding out what works. How can we help people improve their lives? And then, really importantly for me too, this is not the only thing. We're doing the Anoak Recovery Center and other paths to treatment. We're doing enforcement. We've hired more police officers in the city of Winnipeg, and we're doing prevention. Going to make sure there's the right services and more teachers in NYC is hopefully a prevention for many things, including crime in the community, but hopefully it's also a prevention of people ending up using meth or resorting to intravenous drug use when they're older. So we've got to have that four pillars that Dr. Rusin and public health people talk about: prevention, harm reduction, treatment, and enforcement. We're doing a bit of all of them right now, but certainly given the scale of the tragedy that we see out our windows and on our streets, we gotta do a whole heck of a lot more.
In your mind, though, if you had followed through with that location, and is it the same location that you're now using for the trailers? Yeah. So if you had followed through with that location at the foot of the Disraeli Bridge, would it have made the area safer or more dangerous?
Well, no, I don't think it would have made it more dangerous. I think it would have helped to make the province safer, because you would see one more outlet for a pathway to healthcare and treatment and all those other benefits.
One thing that has come up a lot, of course, we've just come from the second highest wildfire season on record, which naturally not only impacted people, but also impacted wildlife. And many First Nations have criticized or engaged or you know, even set up a blockade to moose hunting this past year. So there's been a sort of a complicated process of consultation. Consultation is always complicated. The province has set up sort of a no buffer zone or a no hunting zone, but then also kind of came later to the game into the eyes of Bloodvane First Nation. But do you think that we've got to deal with moose hunting in a much more proactive way? And is it prudent to increase the number of tags for non-Indigenous hunters? Because there's a sort of critical shortage of moose that Indigenous peoples keep talking about. And then this is seems to be a burgeoning issue, which reminds you a lot of lobster fishing out on the East Coast that has become a very First Nations Canadian conflict.
Well, I view myself as a Canadian, in addition to being an Anishinaabe person. I don't know. Is this causing a lot of conflict between people at Tim Hortons? This is one of the things where I do encourage media to be self-reflective. Certainly, there is an issue here, and I'll address it, but I just want to make that comment first. Everybody loves moose meat because it is the best meat that there is. It tastes delicious. And if you drop a moose, there's a ton of it to go around. So I get why there's an interest there. The treaty right to hunt is probably one of the more clearly defined treaty rights that exists out there in Canadian law. And it's very important to First Nations people. And at the same time, licensed hunters, if you will, also have a strong interest and are, let's be honest, come from families who have been hunting moose for generations in many cases. It's true there's some folks who just watched Joe Rogan and then decided to become hunters, but in Manitoba, a lot of people who do it are, yeah, that was a joke. A lot of other people,
Yeah,
they
we
learn
got
how to
it.
hunt from, dad or grandpa or with mom and grandma, and it's just something that they do. And, my approach in government is I want us to focus on what unites us. And the reality is, if you look at the hunter on the reserve who's trying to fill the freezer with moose, and you look at the rural person leaving Bass Pro Shops in Winnipeg who's also trying to fill the freezer with moose, there's probably more in common there than you would get from the first glance at this issue. You probably are, and I've been that more from just beyond you both like the taste of moose meat, right? And you're both gun owners. I also mean you're both probably dealing with a rising cost of living. You're both probably filling the freezer in part because of what's happened with inflation. You're both probably worried about whether your kids are going to be better off than you are today. And you see Donald Trump and Mark Carney and myself and whoever else, and you don't know what to make of it all. And you probably have aspirations, but also a certain amount of fear for the future. And I want to crack the code on how we can connect that. Just to veer dramatically off course here, my dad adopted the Archbishop, the residential school survivor, adopted the Archbishop of Winnipeg in a traditional ceremony, which on the face of it, wow, worlds collide, totally different. But when you take the residential school and Archbishop labels off, and you take the Indigenous, non-Indigenous label off, these are just two guys who are both from rural Manitoba who grew up in the country and then made their lives in the city and saw the best of what Canada had to offer. They're actually very, very common. And so I guess the first step when we're talking about an issue like moose is, like, can we not inflame the issue? So putting up, and I've had this conversation with the chief directly. I was like, so you put up a sign that says 267 band members only. So does that mean other people from Treaty 5 can't go there because they have a different band number? Or what about me? I'm from Treaty 3, but linguistically speaking, in terms of Anishinaabe nationhood, we're the same people. Does that mean I can't go there? Okay, well, the treaty is about sharing. Can we all share this resource? Or what do we think? And then we go to the other side of the equation, Manitoba Wildlife Federation. Okay, you say in your public statements that you recognize that treaty rights are very clearly defined in this area. You say in your public statements that everybody should have a right to harvest moose. I agree. So what are we trying to turn this into an acrimonious issue for? Isn't this more a question of just getting everyone around the table together and trying to find a path forward? I think so, and I hope so. Again, like the landfill issue was an attempt to politicize division in our society. And I just really want us to be a force as a government, but also as a province. I want us, meaning the people of Manitoba, I want us to be a force for reducing division in our society and finding a way to bring people together. And I get it. It's frustrating if you feel like that's not fair to me because I'm First Nations, or that's not fair to me because I'm a licensed hunter and there's not enough moose to go around. But I just want to appeal to people that let's keep working together. Let's be patient. We're not playing favorites. And if you want proof, I'm getting sued by everybody. Okay. I get sued by multiple First Nations every week. The wildlife, lobby organizations have taken action against our government as well too. So just by, who's getting dragged to court, maybe we are in a very awkward way stumbling towards a balanced approach.
Given though that, I mean, I think you've eloquently explained, I mean, there is a deep shared interest in this resource. It's not one group of people, it's multiple groups of people all interested in essentially the same thing. But I'm just wondering if you're concerned that when the decision was made to add 40% more tags for this season, the newest or the freshest surveillance data that your government had was already 18 months old. So there was apparently more surveillance that was done in Q1 of this year, but that data apparently those numbers aren't crunched yet and aren't available for public consumption. So there was and I think this has to be part of you can't survey every moose in the province, right? Like they won't allow, the moose won't allow it, right? Just by the way they move around. But in the
Oh yeah, don't
methodology
get
that
me
was
started on
used,
the moose lobby. They're a tough
yeah, no, exactly.
customer.
As soon as they get a lawyer, you're in trouble. But it doesn't appear that the Natural Resources Department was working with very current data when it made its decision. And I'm wondering if there is a concern there that in fact everybody who's interested in moose could share in.
So like this is the PCs, right? They didn't count moose. They hired a firm to do it that came back with an unusable number during the last year or so in office. And then now again, this is what the PCs do on every issue in Manitoba. They don't want to solve the issue, they want to run on it, right? They had the chance in
No,
office
for
to bring
sure.
people together. They failed to do so, and now they want to use it as like, oh, you got to choose sides on this issue. So, let's keep them on the sidelines until they choose a new complement of their team, I would suggest to you, the voter. But when you're talking about the specific numbers, yeah, we did a number of GHAs, game hunting areas, for folks who may not know the lingo. But last year, and again more recently, we do have those numbers. And what I've been pushing the department as well as our team to do is like, let's make these decisions based on the evidence. And so that's the approach that we need to take. And again, yeah, it would be great if we knew where every moose in the province was. It would make that project a lot easier. But the reality is, even in a world without perfect information, we should be able to get along and live together.
Okay.
And that's what I'm appealing to people for on this one.
Just we're going to wrap up with most recently one of the bond rating agencies expressed concern that Manitoba was going to miss its deficit target for this year. And I know, quite frankly, we're probably going to get some updated quarterly information in the not too distant future. Are you gonna hit the deficit target number? Are you gonna miss it higher, or do you think you can do better?
So there's a number of releases that'll happen. The main thing that Moody's said is that they affirmed our credit rating, and they said that
They did.
we're a serious outfit when it comes to managing the province's books, and this is in line with what all the rating agencies have said since we took office. S&P, Moody's, DBRS, Morningstar, they've all said that we've restored fiscal governance after, the spending spree to buy re-election that Heather Stephenson and the current PC leader launched during the dying days of their administration. So the big picture is that we're a serious outfit. You look across the country right now, there are the beginning signs of the stress from the tariff situation. The last national GDP numbers were not great. As you know, they were negative, hinting at potentially the start of a recession. Here in Manitoba, we've been good at sort of having that diversified economy be the steady hand, if you will, to date. We are going to be providing two updates by the end of the month. One is, I guess, the final statement for last year, and the other one is the I guess current fiscal year update that we have to share. And yeah, you'll see well, hey, should I scoop myself here or should I make you read the news?
100%. Well, like we are serious journalists. We're a serious outfit here,
I can see that.
interested in the news. So bring it
Yeah.
on,
So, like, you'll
Premier.
see, honestly, you'll see a mixed bag. So you'll see that we've outperformed in some areas, and in other areas we're still going through some challenges. And the reality is, I don't think that'll surprise anyone in a year that's been characterized provincially by Donald Trump and wildfires and all these kind of emergent issues. So the main thing is, as I was saying, I guess right at the start of the conversation, when you come into government, there's all these unexpected things. But when it comes to the fiscal side, the arbiters of fiscal performance, the credit rating agencies, have affirmed that we have a steady hand when it comes to the province's books. And we're just working as a team to navigate through these different ups and downs that comes along the way. Because at the end of the day, this is your money, the people of Manitoba. We got to be responsible with it. And you deserve to have these great things like a f improved healthcare system, better outcomes when it comes to homelessness, and some help with the cost of living. And so we're working to deliver those things. And the way you make it happen is by being good with the finances along the way.
We're into the second half of your time as premier. You've riding still a very high popular rating, still Canada's most popular
Highly
premier.
correlated with my appearances on the Negan Won't
I was
Rain
going to
Here
say
podcast.
your popularity is, 60, depending on what issue this week, between 60 and 65% support, but you get 100% support on this podcast for showing up. So we just want to say a big miigwech and thanks for coming.
Okay, so there you go. You've just made my re-election pamphlet, endorsed by
Oh.
Negan and
Yeah.
the
Hey, listen, you want to know something? If you can carry that into campaign, okay, then that may be your greatest accomplishment.
Oh, I might lose the endorsement by the campaign. If I keep this up, I will probably.
Thanks so much for coming on the podcast. Miigwech, thanks so much. So Miigwech, everybody, thanks so much for listening to the beginning of our season. Did you think we'd make it this far, Dan?
I was a little surprised we got one done.
Well,
And I mean, by one, I mean
I
one
was going to
episode.
say,
So, yeah.
I'm still surprised that we get along so good and that you love me this much, this far into our journey together.
I love you madly, brother. I love you madly.
Everybody for being part of the journey, and thanks to everybody for starting off our season here. Thanks to everybody at the Free Press, Wendy Swatsky and all the crew. We really also appreciate everybody that's supporting us in the different ways that we write, particularly our newsletters. You can go subscribe to those for free on the Free Press website. And a big thanks to you, Dan, from afar. But I still want you to come home.